Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Russian President Vladimir Putin penned an op-ed in the New York Times on Thursday called A Plea for Caution from Russia. He warned that a military attack on Syria by the United States could unleash terrorism, increase violence, and further destabilize the Middle East. This op-ed is receiving widespread attention. The New York Times public editor, Margaret Sullivan, penned a piece called The Story Behind the Putin Op-Ed Article in the New York Times. And the New York Times also reveals that Ketchum Communications actually placed the op-ed. In November, ProPublica reporter Justin Elliott explored how Ketchum places pro-Russia op-eds in American publications by business people and others without disclosing the role of the Russian government. His piece is called From Russia with PR, and he reports that Ketchum's latest public filing says it was paid $1.9 million by Russia for the six-month period ending May 31st. It received another $3.7 million for its work for Russian energy giant Gazprom over the same period. Justin Elliott is a reporter with ProPublica, where he covers politics with a focus on money and influence. Hi, Justin. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Great to have you. And we're also joined by David K. Johnston, a columnist with Tax Analysts and the Columbia Journalism Review. David's latest book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, is now out in paperback. We'll talk with David about his book, and we'll also talk about media coverage of the budget and a new study showing that the gap between the richest 1% and the rest of America is the widest it's been since the Roaring Twenties. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, thank you for joining us. And David, why don't we start off with you? As you know, on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there are a number of reporters who did the same story that's on front pages today. I would cite Brooke Barnes at the New York Times about Voyager leaving the solar system. They've calculated now it actually left the solar system in 2012. That's a remarkable achievement. I'm old enough to remember when we were spending 1% of our economy on space exploration in the mid-1960s. And I wish we would go back to doing more of this, but the most amazing things is that in some of the stories on this, they report that, sci-fi fans love to tell you that when you hear noise in a science fiction movie, that's crazy. There's no air, so there can't be sound out in the universe. Beyond the solar system, well, it appears there is sound. And that's an astonishing discovery, that the material that they are finding out beyond the end of our solar system is active and moving around, and it generates at least what we detect through Voyager. This is 1960s computer technology.
Wow.
To be sound.
Wow, this is a nice break from budgets and gaps between the rich and the poor for a minute, David. How much do we spend today on space?
Oh, I think it's in the neighborhood of $20 billion or less. It's not a serious major enterprise anymore. Of course, a lot of the original spending probably was military related, and even though NASA was supposed to be civilian, certainly there was a lot of crossover research. But, you know, the efforts to get us into space led to some terrific inventions. It also gave us Tang, but everything can't be perfect. But it also went to the human spirit, this idea that we should be exploring and understanding our universe and looking beyond where we are. And frankly, when I was a teenager, I thought by now we would have colonized the moon and gotten to Mars, which we could have done had we chosen to do so. And it would have led to a lot more focus on investment in science and knowledge and a lot more thinking about the future instead of a lot of what I believe we've made an error about in this country, which is we're busy protecting fortunes made in the past instead of thinking about how to build a better future.
And just a couple facts. I was looking at the study that came out from Science Magazine or the Science Journal. Voyager 1 is now traveling at 38,000 miles per hour relative to the sun. And there are 80,000 particles per cubic meter in the region where Voyager 1 is now.
Yeah, that is astonishing, 80,000 particles. Because, of course, we think of space as being empty. And it's indicative of how little we really know and how much better off we would be if we would learn a lot more.
Mm. All right. Well, thanks for that one. And we'll put links to these pieces about Voyager 1 on our website right after the show. And what about you, Justin? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yeah, I would point to a piece that actually a colleague of mine here, ProPublica, published, Marion Wang, looking at how state universities are shifting their financial aid resources away from needy, poor students to wealthier students. And this was sort of a lengthy investigation she did that is spotlighting something that I think is a real problem and people should know about. So
and,
I recommend checking that out.
What explains the changes?
Well, to some extent, there's been a reduction in overall resources from states to state universities, but also a lot of these state universities are trying to up their rankings and, attract students with higher test scores and that sort of thing. But those also tend to be students who come from sort of a more higher class background. So the result is these financial aid resources, which are supposed to be, I think in an ideal world would be helping poor kids get to state universities, are a bigger share of them are going to wealthier students.
What was involved in the reporting on this? Because a ProPublica analysis of new data from the Department of Education shows that from 96 through 2012, public colleges and universities gave a declining portion of grants to students in the lowest quartile of family income. And she profiles a young woman, Shaniqua Epps, who looks great on paper, 3.8, all of these extracurricular activities, and just couldn't get a single dollar of aid.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this story, like a lot of good investigations, I think, had two aspects. One was data that came from the Department of Education that Marion analyzed, but the other was talking to a lot of people who, both university administrators and students, their families on the other side of it, that sort of confirmed that this is something that's been going on. So a lot went into it. This was a project that took many months.
And Justin, this piece is really long, and the reporters at ProPublica do such an excellent job on these investigative pieces. What do you all do to make sure that these stories actually get highlighted and that they're seen by a lot of people? Just because there's so much out there, and it's hard to elevate these kinds of stories sometimes.
Yeah, well, we actually have a great team of people here who help promote the stories, both sort of on social media and other publications. This particular story actually also ran on the website of the Chronicle of Higher Education, and also will be in the print edition. And that's that's sort of a niche publication, but it's widely read at colleges and universities around the whole country. So I think this, when the print edition of the Chronicle comes out with the story, a lot of university administrators who are, behind some of these decisions will read the story. So often we seek out partners who, to target the audiences that we're trying to reach.
David, what do you make of this? At a time when student debt has surpassed credit card debt, and so many students are having a really hard time affording, state colleges, in some cases community colleges here in California, because the fees are so high. And now we're learning that low-income students aren't even receiving financial aid because it's going to the wealthy.
Well, this is part of a fundamental problem that we have in our society, where we are not thinking about the future and investing in the future. The trend in this direction is not entirely new. The New York Times did a big piece some years ago pointing out that students from the top quartile were getting a growing share of scholarship and other money. And in the long run, this will contribute to inequality. It will have a devastating effect on the work ethic, because, why work hard and tell your kids to study in school and work hard if you're never going to get anywhere beyond where you are? And it is really fundamentally to the core of this problem that we're busy protecting the fortunes made in the past and not thinking about creating the broad wealth in the future.
And later in the show, we'll talk with you about the new study that came out that found the income gap between the rich and the poor is the biggest in a century. So thank you for that, Justin. Again, Justin's colleague Marion Wang wrote this piece for ProPublica, Public Universities Ramp Up Aid for the Wealthy, Leaving the Poor Behind. We should do a show about that. So it's so important. So let's dive in and talk about this op-ed that was penned by Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday, called A Plea for caution from Russia, and he warned that a military attack on Syria by the U.S. could unleash terrorism, increase violence, and further destabilize the Middle East. And Justin, back in November, you wrote a story called From Russia with PR, taking a look at Ketchum Communications, this PR firm that's hired by the Russian government to place op-eds. So did Ketchum place this op-ed in the New York Times?
They did, actually, and the Times has acknowledged that publicly. And I should say, like, I don't think there's really anything particularly wrong with that transaction. I mean, this is, you know, the firm works for the Russian government, and they're putting out an op-ed by, you know, the president of Russia. But it is sort of an interesting opportunity to look at this world that, you know, we don't hear about that often, of these American PR firms that work for foreign governments, sometimes governments that, you know, from time to time have different, very different foreign policy goals from official U.S. policy. And I think this is sort of one of those times.
So what can you tell us about this, and how often does this happen?
Well, Ketchum is, you know, it's a huge global PR firm. It's based here in New York, where I also am, and they have offices all over the world. And they have worked for Russia. They're actually technically Russia's registered foreign agent in the United States. It turns out there's a law that if you're an American company working for a foreign government and doing lobbying on their behalf, you have to register with the U.S. Department of Justice and make regular disclosures about what sort of work you're doing, how much they're paying you. And that's actually why I was able to write the story I did last November, because there's public documents that describe the sort of work Ketchum does. And, I mean, this is, and it's a pretty big account for them. I mean, they get paid on the order of about $4 million a year by the Russian government. They also separately work for Gazprom, which is, you know, the huge Russian energy company, and they make, I think, on the order of about $7 or $8 million a year for them. So they do, you know, they correspond with journalists. They get op-eds placed, which I can talk more about if you want. They, you know, maintain social media accounts, set up meetings with government officials, that sort of thing.
David, how important is it for a publication to reveal the original source? Because Margaret Sullivan, the public editor at The New York Times, wrote a piece yesterday called The Story Behind the Putin Op-Ed, and then she updated it today, revealing that this piece did in fact come from Ketchum. But she had to do that after it got a lot of attention, specifically on Twitter.
Yeah, I was sort of dumbfounded that Margaret Sullivan's original piece didn't tell us that. Justin's one of the very few reporters who has mined these documents you have to file with the Justice Department when you're a foreign agent. And they should be a bed of a lot of stories about things that we hear and we don't realize come to us because of relationships like this. I think it's terrific that the New York Times ran this op-ed. I think it gives us a very good insight into the mentality of the quote-unquote elected end quote, czar of Russia, and but it should have been disclosed in the original that there was, because of the nature of it, I think, the connection is here. But many, many op-eds you read in many newspapers are written by public relations people. You know, anybody who thinks that Henry Kissinger sits down and actually pens a piece rather than having somebody do it for him, or Jeffrey Immelt at General Electric does it rather than one of his staff, you know, just is being naive.
I should add here, I mean, like, I agree with David's take. I mean, I don't think there's anything, like, sort of fundamentally wrong with the Times running this op-ed. I mean, I think it's interesting for American readers to get the sort of unadulterated take of, you know, the leader of a foreign government. But I will also add that Ketchum has been involved in some sketchier activity in the past. Actually, what I was writing about last November was the fact that they were having third-party academics and business people write these pro-Russia op-eds that were sort of almost comically pro-Russia. I think one of them called Russia, like, the most dynamic place in the world for investors, that sort of thing. And they ran on CNBC and Huffington Post, and they didn't disclose that, you know, the Russian government the Russian government through its foreign agent, Ketchum, had been involved in soliciting and placing these op-eds. So for the reader, you're just looking at these pro-Russia columns by, you know, what seems like some academic who knows what they're talking about. without being told that actually the Russian government was placed this. And as David mentioned, the way that I was able to figure that out was because they revealed it in their disclosures with the Justice Department.
And that is Justin Elliott. He's a reporter with ProPublica covering politics with a focus on money and influence. You can find his piece From Russia with PR on our website. David K. Johnston is a columnist with Tax Analyst and the Columbia Journalism Review. David's latest book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, is now out in paperback. And we'll talk about that a little later in the show. And if you'd like to talk about this op-ed and just how the op-eds work, because they're so incredibly influential in this country, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And how important is it for you? Like, for example, if this piece ran and it said Vladimir Putin and this piece was placed by Ketchum, how would you respond to that? And if you didn't know about this, what are your thoughts on it now? Unfortunately, our email is down, so you can't email us. But if you have a comment you'd like to share, you can also put it on our website, yourcallradio.org, or give us a call at 866-798-8255. We also found a piece in Business Insider showing that Ketchum was involved in high-profile controversies in 2004 and 2005. In both cases, the Government Accountability Office determined that Ketchum, again a PR firm, engaged in covert propaganda for the U.S. government. In 2004, Ketchum produced prepackaged stories featuring actors posing as journalists that touted the Medicare changes under George W. Bush's prescription drug program. Didn't disclose the source. And then in 2005, Ketchum produced prepackaged stories about No Child Left Behind. And then ProPublica revealed that in 2010, Ketchum was awarded a stimulus contract from the Obama administration to promote its push for electronic medical records. So, David, Ketchum is doing a lot of op-ed writing and these prepackaged news stories, but it's not being revealed.
Right. And this is not unique at all to Ketchum. Burson Marsteller, Hill and Knowlton, all the other big firms have operations like this. They shape a lot of what's in the news. And one of the things that's happened as news organizations have shrunk and become less powerful is their significance has grown greatly. There's a blog for journalists called Romanesco. And yesterday, the blogger broke the story of how the football coach at the University of South Carolina effectively got the reporter, columnist, who covered the team for the local newspaper, The State, which is owned by McClatchy, a Sacramento company, removed because he wasn't happy with what he wrote. And there's a great deal, I've mentioned this on your show before, there's a great deal of cowing of the press and distorting things going on that isn't being reported on because the press is in such a weakened condition. And ProPublica has been one of the a few outfits, because it's not advertising dependent, it doesn't have a business model that is based on publishing a paper, it puts things on the internet and partners with other people, that has not been, I think, negatively influenced by this. But every other news organization, including the Journal and the Times and the Chronicle, they've all had episodes that demonstrate this fundamental problem. As the number of journalists in America has rapidly shrunk, the readership has shrunk, and the influence has shrunk. And one of the results of this is that government is a lot less responsive to problems that are then reported in the news, and things don't get fixed like they used to get fixed.
Well, we have a number of calls on this, so let's hear from Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious to know what your guests think that Putin's op-ed meant. I couldn't really tell when I read it. I thought, well, gosh, is this a threat or is he trying? I couldn't really tell, but it had vague feelings of iron inside, soft gloves. So I'd really like to know what you think.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye, David. Did you read the Putin op-ed?
Yes. And I mean, I think it struck me as being fairly clear in that. Understand that the Russians have one military base outside of their country in that area of the world. Syria is essentially their satellite, and they definitely want to keep the family, the Bashar family, in power. And were implying to the U.S. that, you know, you're going to regret this without quite saying it. And they were also trying, of course, to diminish. They knew this would be read all over. It wasn't written for Americans. It was written for the world. This was a way of slapping around the U.S. government in a world where a lot of people are saying, why is the U.S. always invading other countries and solving things with weaponry instead of economic sanctions and diplomacy?
And Justin, what was your read?
Yeah, one line that jumped out at me that I think was kind of ridiculous was where there's one sentence where he just asserts without offering any evidence that the chemical weapons attack that happened a few weeks ago was committed by the rebels or some faction of the rebels, and I think he said that it was becoming obvious that that was the case. And you know, I don't think the U.S. government has offered a perfect case. They haven't presented that much evidence publicly, but they've certainly offered a lot more evidence than, you know, one sentence in an op-ed, which is what Putin, which is all Putin offered. So I thought that seemed pretty ridiculous. But I mean, I don't think it was wrong of the Times to print that, because again, I think it's interesting and useful for people to read what, you know, the president of Russia thinks about the situation right now.
Well, and we talked about how just the lack of information that's coming out last week, and Representative Alan Grayson actually penned an op-ed in the New York Times saying that he's been asking for classified information, and so far all they've received is a 12-page document. And then once they receive it, they're under such tight restrictions they can't really talk to their constituents about it. So thank you for calling in. Eileen, let's hear next from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call on a good program. First of all, regarding President Putin's op-ed in the New York Times, is there reciprocity? Can American interests put such op-eds in Russian newspapers? And then I'd like to say very quickly that there is a great deal of hypocrisy involved here, because it seems to me that when it comes to caution, the Russians have not been very good at exercising caution in Georgia, in Chechnya. I can think of the way they implement very cautiously democratic rule in Russia, or implement all sorts of laws targeting homosexuals in Russia. And in addition, last but not least, from the get-go, when the Ba'ath power emerged in Syria under Hafez al-Assad, the Russians have backed the regime. So they've provided it with weapons, including chemical weapons, and they have provided it with diplomatic support. So I have a real problem with the whole thing. I'd love to have your feedback.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for calling. David, do you want to take that first?
Well, certainly you're much less likely to see something like this in the Soviet Union. And, of course, Tsar Putin has used the legal system there because the judiciary is not independent. And if our freedom in America depends on anything, it is an independent judiciary to lock up, you know, political opponents, three members of the women's band Pussy Riot, and others. And he's certainly a deadly piece of work. I mean, there's plenty of evidence that Putin was behind the plutonium deaths of the former Russian spy, whose name I can't remember at the moment, in London, and some other acts. But that said, better we hear what it is they want the world to know rather than depend solely on the secret diplomatic cables of the U.S. to the extent that since WikiLeaks they're still secret.
That is David K. Johnston. He's a columnist with Tax Analyst and the Columbia Journalism Review. His book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, is out in paperback. And we'll talk about that in the second half of the show. We're also joined by Justin Elliott, a reporter with ProPublica, covering politics with a focus on money and influence. His piece, From Russia with PR, received a lot of attention after the Putin op-ed ran, and the New York Times was then forced yesterday to add a clause to their piece saying that, yes, this piece did come from Ketchum Communications. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin. It's Matt Martin, general manager of KALW. You're listening to the Your Call Media Roundtable this time of the week here on Fridays when Rose and her guests inform you about the news and how it is made. If you tune in on Friday mornings and you say, I learned something here, I find out what's really going on, show your support now. Say yes to this work that Rose Aguilar, Malihe Razazan, who's at the controls right now, taking calls, talking to you, finding these great guests to bring on the program. Your support makes that possible.
800-525-9917, or you can log on to our website, kalw.org. Your support really does make everything we do on Your Call possible. Rose Aguilar here with you every morning at 10 o'clock. Join us now with your contribution, 800-525-9917.
And we do have David K. Johnston's book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use quote-unquote plain English to rob you blind. And this is a great book that's just out in paperback. David K. Johnston is one of those voices we bring back again and again on the Media Roundtable because he's great and because he knows a lot of stuff. And when it comes to corporate hijinks and the way that the tax system works, there is nobody better than David K. Johnston. For a $120 contribution to KALW, we will send you his book as our thanks.
My favorite part of the Media Roundtable is when they talk about the stories that they thought were worth reading during the last week. If you appreciate Rose and Your Call and all the people we have here at Local Public Radio who put this program together, join us now in support of KALW during our fall membership campaign in support of Your Call.
800-525-9917. Going back to the program, we're going to be keeping everything uninterrupted in this campaign. Your support makes that approach possible. 800-525-9917.
Or you can log on to the website and make a secure donation there at kalw.org. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. You're listening to Your Call.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. On Monday, we'll have a conversation with Marion Nessel about her new book, Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics. And then on Tuesday, we'll welcome back Josh Fox, environmental activist. He's out with a new documentary, Gasland 2. It's a sequel to the 2010 film, and it's drawn so much attention to the dangers of hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. And a diluted fracking bill has passed the Senate in California, so we'll get an update on what is happening in California and across the country. So be sure to tune in for that. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback. Actually, don't do that because our email's down. Maybe on Monday, hopefully it'll be back. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we are joined by David K. Johnston, columnist with Tax Analysts and the Columbia Journalism Review. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. It's now out in paperback. And Justin Elliott is a reporter with ProPublica, covering politics with a focus on money and influence, revealing that the Putin op-ed came directly from Ketchum Communications. Ketchum was paid almost $2 million by Russia for the first 6 months of this year. And Justin, we've got just a couple more calls on Russia and this op-ed. So let's hear from Stephanie in Los Altos. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if either of the guests would like to comment on the comment stream following Putin's op-ed, which when I last looked was at over 4,000 comments. It's something I've never seen any similar thing. And a lot of them very intelligent, interesting comments. I can't say I read all 4,000, but I was surprised at how worthwhile they were. So for me, that was in some ways one of the very best things about this op-ed running.
Interesting. So right now it's at 4,127.
Wow. David,
have you looked at any of these comments?
I have not looked at the comments on those.
And Justin, did you?
I also have to admit I did not look. That's sort of a policy I generally keep.
Well, you know, I have to say that the New York Times actually does have some pretty good comments because they parse it out. You can pick all reader picks or New York Times picks. So your best bet is to hit the picks, and that's when you'll get the best comments. But sorry, we didn't read the comments, Stephanie. So thank you for calling in. But maybe we'll take a look and then maybe comment on it next week. Let's hear from, actually, Harry just dropped. Actually, I think we're done with the Putin calls, but I did want to ask you one more question. Oh, we have Harry. Hi, Harry.
Hi. I just got disconnected briefly.
Okay.
I wanted to say that I think it's important not only what op-eds are, what you read in the op-eds, but the fact who decides what the op-eds are. And the Examiner and the Chronicle are both controlled by corporate interests, and their op-eds reflect that, but also what they publish. So it's very easy for someone who's a department head in San Francisco to get an op-ed in favor of something that, that supports corporate line, and very difficult for someone to get an opposing point of view. And I think if you look at the Wall Street Journal, it's almost all propaganda, and even their review section is pretty disgusting because when they review books, if it's by someone who puts, you know, what might be called a liberal or progressive point of view, they attack the book in the review and the grounds of the review, and there's never, ever a positive review of things like that.
Well, thank you for calling in, Harry. I'm glad you brought that up, because about 85% of op-eds are written by white men, and only about 15% are written by women and people of color. Justin, do you want to quickly talk about just how you get an op-ed placed and what people need to know about these op-eds when they read them?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would encourage people to read op-eds and, for that matter, the news section critically. And I think part of that is definitely looking at who owns the newspaper or the media organization, who the editors are who are deciding this, and also, you know, just from sort of a logical perspective, who's getting published on the op-ed page, who's not getting published, you know, what topics are being covered, what topics are not being covered. I think you should be thinking about all of those things while you're reading. And as you say, white men are obviously far overrepresented. There's actually a organization that I believe is called the Op-Ed Project that's devoted to to sort of fixing the gender inequity on op-ed pages. But I don't think these things can always be explained by sort of corporate interests of, say, the Wall Street Journal determining who's on the op-ed page. I think often it's just a question of basic ideological affiliations. But I take the caller's point.
Yeah, I did some work with the Op-Ed Project. The other problem is that people just don't pitch. Women only pitch about 12% of op-eds, and we're getting placed about 12% of the time. So we're actually doing really well. The thing is, you just need to start pitching.
That's right, and obviously the editors of an op-ed page, I mean, I think the New York Times is probably the most influential one in the country. I mean, they sort of play a gatekeeper function, and are therefore incredibly influential. And I think they should be questioned. And I think the Times is pretty transparent. Andrew Rosenthal, I think, is the editor of the op-ed page, and I see him quoted fairly often when either the Times' own public editor or some media reporter is writing about some issue involving the op-ed page. He usually seems pretty willing to talk about it, and I give him credit for that.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Justin Elliott. He's a reporter with ProPublica, a nonprofit where he covers politics with a focus on money and influence. And David K. Johnston will be with us for the rest of the hour. His latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, and it's now out in paperback. And David, before we dive in and talk about your book and the budget and the gap between the rich and the poor, what are your thoughts on just how people should navigate the media world? Because, I mean, if you're reading an op-ed and you want to know where it originates, what is the responsibility of citizens? I mean, you pick up a paper and you kind of hope that you have some kind of trust in what you're reading.
Well, the op-ed page and the editorial page, of course, are where the owner gets their unfettered interests and should. They shouldn't be messing around in the news department. And at the best newspapers, they don't. For example, the New York Times every afternoon at about 5 o'clock has a meeting where all the section editors or department editors come in to pitch what they want to get on page one. The publisher of the New York Times sometimes comes to that meeting. After a half an hour, when the pitching is done, all the department heads leave and only the front page senior editors remain to decide what will go on the front page, and the publisher also leaves. So he has an idea of what might appear prominently in the paper tomorrow, but he doesn't know where it will appear and has no role in it. And when I worked there, I was told that there had been two occasions anybody could recall when the publisher had stayed. One of them apparently because he just wanted to watch the process.
Hmm.
By the way, this thing about op-eds, it would be interesting to look at the op-eds in the L.A. Times, because the op-ed editor there is Sue Horton. So you have one of the few women who's an op-ed editor in the country, and see if her mix of pieces is any different. But the caller who referred to the placement of these by city department heads, by corporations, et cetera, is exactly right. And it's because they have polished PR people who are working on getting across their issues. And we certainly would be better off if we had a more robust variety of positions and pros and cons that ran in op-ed pages. And likewise, by the way, book reviews, even though two of my books have been Wall Street Journal bestsellers, the Wall Street Journal has never reviewed my book, but they have reviewed a number of books that rank below 2 million on Amazon.
They've never reviewed your book?
No. And and I find that actually intriguing because those of your listeners who read my books know that my books argue for more competition in the marketplace and for investors rather than corporate executives. But that is not certainly the way the journal editors would see my work. They see it as just being critical of business, not of promoting good business practices.
So The Fine Print is your third book in a series of reporting that you've done. 8 years ago, you published Perfectly Legal About the Tax System and how it's a subsidy system for the super rich. And then Free Lunch, a really great book. We had you on about that a bunch of times, about the taxes you pay really going to various corporations. And then The Fine Print is looking at how businesses just rip us off on a regular basis without many of us either knowing it or we're just so used to it that we no longer question it.
And getting laws passed that enable them doing that.
Right. So So now that this book is out in paperback, it got a fair amount of attention when it came out in hardcover. And how do you think the media cover these issues that you explore and reveal?
Oh, they're not being covered. I wrote a story for the American Journalism Review for what turned out to be its last print issue, and it was the missing story, and it was just example after example of things that are going on in state capitals, Sacramento, Albany, elsewhere, that are either not being covered at all or the coverage is so superficial and disjointed it doesn't mean anything. And, you know, the fastest disappearing white-collar job in America, the last time I looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data, was journalist. In Philadelphia, more than 80% of the journalism jobs covering various aspects of city government, schools, cops, police, city council, they've gone away in the last 12 years. 80%.
Wow.
The scandal in Bell, California, with the $800,000 salary for the city manager, it would never have happened if any reporter had covered the Bell City Council. They did it all in the open. And this is, I think, a real challenge. When I started out at the San Jose Mercury in 1968, every week I would go, as did all the reporters who sat around me, to the meetings of school boards and city councils, and we would tell you what your local government was doing. Then the news business got into hiring consultants who said, people don't want to know that stuff. They don't care. Well, you know, my little weekly paper comes, and the one thing I want to know is, so what did the city council do? I don't have time to go to the city council meeting. Give me a report so I just know what they're up to and what the school board's up to. As a homeowner, I want to know these things. And that stuff isn't being covered, and I think it's one reason people are paying much less attention to newspapers. You know, we do a better job of covering who the Kardashian girls are kissing this week than we do of what politicians are doing to your wallet.
Well, the other thing is a lot of journalists are going to work for government. So Time Managing Editor Rick Stengel is leaving journalism to go work for the State Department, making him at least the 15th reporter to work for the Obama administration. He'll be the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. What do you think of this trend?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that number is unusual. I mean, it was interesting that the stories I saw about it did not say, and here's how many went to work for the George Bush administration, here's how many worked for Clinton, and, you know, all the way back to Eisenhower. A lot of people in those positions come from journalism. Journalism is just shrinking like crazy. NPR just announced today that they're laying off 10% of their staff.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
NPR that got a $200 million endowment from Joan Kroc of the McDonald's fortune. And, you know, we are seeing a tremendous decrease. The only organization that is spending big on news in this country right now and expanding the news is Al Jazeera, which is, if you go look at their reports, man, this terrific journalism that they're producing.
You know, I haven't watched it since the debut. What are you seeing?
Well, I haven't seen anything because I'm a Time Warner cable customer, and the minute that they bought it, Time Warner took them out of the lineup. But I see their news articles on the web, their print articles, and they've had a whole variety of thoughtful, well-done pieces. They've hired bureaus. You know, the New York Times at its peak had about 24 bureaus around the U.S., and I think the L.A. Times had 15 or 16. I was in San Francisco as one of those reporters near the peak. And but the reporters were like, one in San Francisco, and then Denver might be the next bureau. Al Jazeera has bureaus in places like Salt Lake City and Minneapolis and other cities that have generally not been in Nashville that haven't had national bureaus. And if you read online the reports that they're doing, it's just really thorough, solid work. It's very impressive work.
Mm. We're speaking with David K. Johnston, columnist with Tax Analysts and the Columbia Journalism Review, former tax reporter with the New York Times. His latest book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, is now out in paperback. And we've got about 10 more minutes with David, so if you have any comments or questions about how the media cover the issues like the budget, the gap between the rich and the poor, and just all of these issues that he focuses on, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Our email is down, so please don't email us, but you can leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede.
Hi, good morning. You know, we have to really go back 30 years to economics and trickle-down economy and the whole robbing of the American people by the Wall Street and their media and their cahoots that have taken this country apart. And it includes the whole government, including counties and cities. And I like to say that, you know, whenever I hear the word austerity, after they robbed us all of our homes, of our banks, of our retirement, of our businesses, they talk about austerity. Austerity is the most criminal word Obama or anybody else say. We need to spend money on the society. Banks are not spending money on society. All the money has been recycled between different banks. We need to invest money in jobs because jobs create taxes, and we need to bring the middle class back. As far as cities, the disgraceful cities all over the country, including the city of Berkeley, they all way overpay their elites. The city manager in Berkeley makes $250,000 a year, plus another $250,000 benefit. The retired Berkeley city manager makes $250,000 a year. He retired. So well, it is disgraceful, Rose. It's really disgraceful what happened to this country. And all of us are struggling. Great business Ed had for over $100 million worth of sales, getting hassled by the stupid city of Berkeley. You know, it is just unbelievable how this country got ruined by this.
Thank
by
you.
These people.
Thank you so much, Ed. David, Ed owns an electronic shop in Berkeley, and so he's seen just the massive changes because of outsourcing. But he brought up the budget. And because Syria is getting so much attention, we're seeing so little coverage about budget talks. And the federal budget has been getting very little attention. There could be a shutdown on October 1st. A second round of cuts will be going into effect. And social programs are going to get slammed. Now, the New York Times did have a really good piece last week about food stamps. And they went out into the country, interviewed people who are working, relying on food stamps, and they're going to be cut in November. So can you give us an update? What's at stake here?
Well, what's at stake is very clearly the kind of country we're going to be in the future. I mean, anybody who thinks that and we have a number of senators and congressmen who clearly believe this, that the reason we don't have more people working is that it's easier to go on welfare, which you can only get for 60 months now, 5 years, and live on food stamps and go on disability. The average person on disability in this country gets a payment of less than $1,000 a month, and after 2 years and they go on Medicare, they got to pay about $150 a month to Medicare. Who in the world quits working so they can have $750 a month? That's insane. These budget cuts are broadly damaging the country. We are, most importantly in terms of our long-term wealth, we are cutting spending on basic research and education. And, you know, if you believe, as a number of members of Congress do, that these are the end times, then our policies make absolutely perfect sense.
Well,
but if you believe we're going to be here, you know, long after all of us are gone and our great-grandchildren are gone, then these policies make absolutely no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And yet voters put these people in office, and if they don't remove them, we are going to be poorer, we're going to have social unrest, we're going to have fewer people striving to be successful, and ultimately we will destroy the work ethic that has helped make America so prosperous.
And President Obama's budget would require $57 billion in higher payments by Medicare beneficiaries, cut $306 billion in projected Medicare payments to health providers, and squeeze $19 billion out of Medicaid, which is a program for low-income people.
Right. And as we all know, you know, your local family practice doctor is so highly overpaid. They're not, by the way. Their incomes have all been falling all across the country. we've got a real serious problem here. There's some numbers that just came out that I think people should know. Every year I do analysis of the Sayers-Piketty data from the University of California, where they analyze income tax returns. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans has now fallen below the level of 1966. Now, as I went on your show about a year ago, I pointed out it had gone up $59 in real terms compared to 1966. We've now fallen behind 1966.
Wow.
At the same time, the average income of people at the top, well, not at its peak because the market is so bad. This is the crowd in which Mitt Romney is at the bottom, and at the top you have the Koch brothers and Buffett and Gates and those folks. It's now $31 million average income for the top 1% of the top 1%.
Wow.
And their incomes are five times what they were in 1966. We are not building a sound, stable society in which people who want to work hard will be rewarded for what they do. We are building a society in which those at the very top who want to, it's not everybody at the very top, but those who want to, are mining the economy, destroying wealth, and the fundamental problem is we are protecting the wealth of the past because of our campaign finance system. We are not investing in the wealth of the future.
This latest study that looked at the income gap between the rich and the poor, it's the biggest gap in a century. It's getting so much attention, David. I mean, the LA Times, income gap, biggest in a century. U.S. income gap reaches its widest point since the 1920s enterprise record. NPR, you name it. I mean, it's getting a lot of attention.
And listen, I am thrilled because when I first started writing about the growing income gap 20 years ago, you know, there were all sorts of people telling the New York Times I was crazy. And this was just ridiculous, and these were anomalies. And I'm glad to see that people are finally getting the message. The policies that we began with the election of Ronald Reagan are not working. We have a third of a century of data now that show that they aren't working. What was the promise back then? We're going to get government out of the way, we're going to cut taxes, and you're all going to be better off. Well, we were the biggest creditor nation, now we're the biggest debtor nation. We had reducing poverty back then. Now we have growing poverty. We had a growing population getting college degrees. Now we don't.
And again, corporate profits are also off the charts. And we talked about bank salaries reaching new highs with bonuses. And so what you write about in the fine print is how these corporations are taking advantage of average people, and they're doing it legally. And so you've got so many examples in your book. You look at the AT&T phone bill, for example. You look at several states in the U.S. where large corporations pocket the state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks. As the book is out in paperback now, and you kind of look back at all the research you did, what still really gets you at this point?
Oh, I think there are two things that really gall me. One of them is the fact that America, which invented the internet, is now way down in the rest of the world and yet paying premium prices because we have these giant monopolies and duopolies, AT&T and Verizon on the phone side and Comcast, Cox, Time Warner on the cable side, that are doing the minimal possible investment to delude American people into thinking they have a real high-speed internet when compared to South Korea or even Bulgaria, we're a joke. And so that's one, because that's really damaging our economy. There are lots of, you know, nobody could invent a jet airplane until they knew how to make aluminum. And if we don't have a super high-speed internet available everywhere, all sorts of things are not going to be invented that will make the economy better. The other is this spreading practice that gets worse and worse of corporations getting rules and laws passed where they pocket your tax dollars. It's a small share of your total taxes, but the trend is very clear, and those businesses that benefit from it, Walmart being one of the big champions of this, collect taxes at the cash register and keep the money. That's how Walmart builds a lot of its stores. That's how Cabela's and Home Depot and Lowe's build a lot of their stores. Major corporations like Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation get to keep the state income taxes withheld from some of their workers. Their best evidence is hundreds of thousands of workers and a growing number around the country. And, you know, business should prosper because it succeeds in the marketplace. It shouldn't prosper because it gets a law passed that lets them reach into your pocket. And that's what I explain in the fine print. All these laws and rules the news media hasn't covered. In plain English, here's how they're doing this to you and raising prices, all done through manipulating government policies.
And David, we have about a minute left. What can we do about this?
Well, the first thing you got to do is be informed. That's why I write these books. I mean, I'm never going to somebody who's cynical. I'm never going to make another dollar off this book. I got paid what I'm going to get paid for it, and I'm never going to sell enough copies to make any more. But the first thing you have to do is you have to know what's going on, and then you know you've got to be organized and involved in things. Go join a group or start a group, but be active. You know, when I was coming of age in the '60s, we talked about people being empowered and changing the world, and now what I hear from people is, your question, or often, well, we can't do anything about it. Yes, we can do something about it, but you have to pick an issue and stick with it. Susan B. Anthony died before women got back the right to vote, but it happened. Frederick Douglass spent his whole life working on abolition. You know, things don't change overnight. It takes a long time, but if you don't start now, your grandchildren are going to live in a terrible economy.
Well, David, we'd love to have you back just to focus on solutions. I think we would love to have that for an hour.
That's a book I wish some publisher wanted to publish. They all say when I say that, no, nobody wants to read that.
David, thank you so much. David K. Johnston is author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, and it is now out in paperback. David K. Johnston, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. And I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW, joining Rose here in the studio, asking for your support at 800-525-9917. KALW.org is also a place where you can do that. What's great, Rose, every Friday, ever since the beginning of your call, we always start by talking about something positive, saying, hey, who's doing good work? And right now, during this membership campaign, we want you to walk in that same path to say, let's support the good work. There's a lot of bad news in the economy and in journalism. And here on Your Call on Fridays, we try to focus on what's good and critique what's not and say, how do we make it better? Your support makes that possible. 800-525-9917. This is a place where real news and information is growing thanks to you. Be the next person to call or click. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. I love David K. Johnston and what he said. Be informed, be active, be empowered. That's kind of the motto of this show. And as Matt said, there's so much good journalism out there. It's just not often highlighted, but it is on this show. Malihe Razazan, our producer, does such an amazing job finding these voices, people who put a lot of time into these investigations. That's the kind of journalism you're supporting by calling 800-525-9917. Or KALW.org. We bring on these journalists who spend so much time following the money, filing FOIA requests, holding people accountable, and that's what journalism is supposed to be about. So support that kind of local, independent journalism. 800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org.
David K. Johnston's remarkable book, The Fine Print, yours for a $120 contribution at 800-525-9917. I don't know about you, I can never get enough of David K. Johnston talking about all kinds of issues, but especially when he's really dug in. And when it comes to this question about corporate manipulation of regulation and how it's used to rip us off in small ways that really add up, that's what this book is about. Your support at 800-525-9917 will get the information to you. For a $120 contribution, we'll send you the book.
800-525-9917. And because we're supported by you, we can actually talk about how corporations rip us off. 800-525-9917. And then also, what can we do about it? Because that's the other thing we always talk about on this show. What are the solutions? Who's actually working on this? And how can we take action? 800-525-9917. $120. We'll send you the book. It'll probably make you mad, but then it'll give you some tips on what to do about it and how to talk about these issues. KALW.org or 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. Thanks to everyone who's on the line right now and who's given support in this campaign. Be the next person to call. Thanks.
Thanks for your support.
KALW, San Francisco.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. On World Have Your Say, reaction to the Delhi rapists being sentenced to death.
while the death penalty might have satisfied, you know, the political parties who are going to use this case for their votes, and it's going to satisfy the public who are baying for blood, it's not really going to get justice for anybody.
It was a crime that caused such outrage and nationwide protests, it led to a change in the law. Today, four men have been sentenced to death for the rape and murder of a student on a Delhi bus. While many Indians welcome the sentence, others say it doesn't tackle the fundamental problems facing society, its attitude to women. We'll be live in Delhi. Plus, we're bringing together US students and Russians to have a conversation about their government's approach to the Syrian crisis, as their politicians describe talks as constructive. We're on the hashtag WHYS.